What are three ways that stress can affect us even before we're born? And how can fear and negativity play a role in our genetics? We'll get into all this and more, plus practical applications for integrating brain science into your life and work. Welcome to the Keys to Brain Change with Dr. Bruce Lipton and Dr. Ruth Buzinski.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dr. Ruth Buzinski, a licensed psychologist in the state of Connecticut and the president of the National Institute for the Clinical Application of Behavioral Medicine. We have an expert. He spoke years ago at our conference in Hilton Head, and I was in awe of his ability to bring science and make it real and clear to so many people. And this is Bruce Lipton. He has a doctorate. He's a cell biologist, has a doctorate in from Stanford University, and has done a lot of the groundbreaking stem cell research. He is the author of The Biology of Belief as well as The Honeymoon Effect. And I don't want to spend a whole lot more time talking about Bruce because I want to jump right in and talk with Bruce. So welcome, Bruce. It's good to see you again.
Ruth, I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so happy to have the honor to talk to your audience, because your audience, you know, without even knowing it, has been leading a cultural evolution. And it's really important because they started to move into this nature of how behavior influences health. And this is the area that science is now just unfolding. So pioneers, one and all, and deepest appreciation for taking that step out of the box.
Well, thanks. And so let's just start with what is epigenetics, Bruce, and why does it matter?
Well, epigenetics is the leading edge of science right now, and it's a revolution. It's a complete revolution because we've been programmed with the belief of genetics, which is the story of how genes are ultimately the primary cause of our existence and our expression. So genes create traits, and traits are our lives, and the genes are passed down from parent to child through reproduction. And so we get a set of genes from our mother, our father. These genes come together and unfold, and here we are. And it becomes very important because when we talk about genetics, and we come with a belief that the genes control us. They control our traits. They control the characters of our lives. And then we recognize, well, wait, did I pick these genes? And the answer is no. We don't know. You know, probably not. Maybe we did. But the idea is that our traits are controlled by these genes. And if we are really troubled by the traits we have or want to change the traits, can we change the genes? The answer is no. And then all of a sudden you realize one very important fact. Genes control our lives, but yet we didn't pick them and we can't change them. So by definition, we acquire a belief about genes as we're victims of our heredity, meaning genes control our lives and what can we do about it? And when people buy into victim, that becomes a problem right there, because then they stop trying to take care of themselves because they realize that's not in their domain, but it's other people. So victim means you have to go get a rescuer. And that's the story we grew up with, and that's a story that the books are still saying right now, especially college or high school books, they keep talking about genes controlling life. The new science is called epigenetics, and it sounds almost the same, but there's a prefix epi, and epi is the source of a revolution. Epi means above. So when I say skin, integument, I also can refer to it as epidermis, meaning the layer above the dermis. So if I say epigenetics, then what I'm saying is control above the genes. And all of a sudden it says, well, wait a minute, we thought genes turn on and off and all that stuff. And it's like, genes do not turn on and off. Genes have no self-control. Genes are blueprints. We now know that some action has to select a blueprint and read a blueprint. And all of a sudden we realize, but that action isn't controlled by the genes. And now we start to recognize how that action is controlled by the environment and our perception of the environment. Well, it becomes very significant because if our genes and our life are controlled by our relationship to the environment, then think about the fact that we're not necessarily victims anymore, because we're the ones that can change the environment or change our perception of the environment. And in that case, then we have control above the genes. We have epigenetics. And this is the profound difference, is that we go from a belief that our health is the consequence of being a victim of our mechanical biology to recognizing that our health is predominantly under the control of our perception and our environment. And this becomes a change from victim to master. And this is why it's so important.
So let's get into this idea that life experiences can change our genes. And let's support that. What evidence is there to back that up?
Okay, well, let's first understand how epigenetics came about. And I was fortunately there cloning stem cells, not just finding stem cells, but cloning stem cells. And so I was back like in 1967 culturing stem cells. And while I was doing that, I was involved teaching students, of course, about how genes control life. And I'm cloning stem cells. And you say, well, let's get stem cell definition clear here. A stem cell is just another name for an embryonic cell. If I took a tissue biopsy from you a moment before you were born and then looked at some of the cells, I'd say, oh, here are some embryonic cells. If I took the same tissue biopsy moments after you're born and then look at the same cell, I'd say, oh, there's a stem cell. What it really means is this: once you're born, I can't call it an embryonic cell. But it is an embryonic cell. So stem cells are multipotential, and that's we have them throughout our body because every day we lose hundreds of billions of our normal cells through damage and attrition, just old age. And that means every day you have to replace hundreds of billions of your cells. And the question is, well, where do they come from? The answer is a reserve population of stem cells scattered throughout your body who function as embryonic cells to regrow you every day. So I have these embryonic cells, stem cells, whatever you want to call them. In this case, I was cloning them, and here's the experiment that blew my mind, and it presaged by about 20 some years the science of epigenetics. And it was this experiment. I was growing stem cells in a culture. I put one stem cell in a culture dish by itself. It divides every 10 or 12 hours. So first there's one, then there's 2, 4, 8, 16. After a week in culture, I have about 50,000 cells, all from that one stem cell. But the most important point is they're genetically identical because they all came from the same parent cell. So I have 50,000 genetically identical cells, embryonic cells. But here's what I do. I take some of those stem cells out of that culture dish that I'm growing them in and put them in a different culture dish, and I change the environment. You say, well, what do you mean? What is the environment for a cell? Well, first of all, cells are like fish. They live in fluid. And that's why if you cut yourself open, all the fluid leaks out because it's an aquarium inside. And that the environment is reflected in the composition of whatever I put into that culture medium. So I take the cells out of my stem cell dish and put them into another culture dish, and I change the environment, meaning I change the chemistry of the culture medium a little bit. And in this dish, the cells form muscle. And then I say, wait, go back to the original stem cell dish, get some more of the cells out, put it into a second petri dish with yet a different culture environment, and they form bone. And I go, wait, go back to the same dish and get some more of the stem cells out, put it into a third petri dish, third environment with a little bit different environment, and the cells form fat cells. And now we're left with a very profound question, is what controls the fate of the cells? And the answer simply is this. They were all genetically identical. The only thing that was different was the environment. And in this case, the culture environment, which is the fluid in which I grow the cells. So now we understand that this is the understanding that led to epigenetics, that the signals that control the genetic expression are not in the genes, but are coming from the environment. So this is leading to a whole new understanding. And what it led to me to understand is very important because basically it says this. When we look in the mirror and see ourselves as individuals, entities, yes, I'm a single human being, but by definition, a human being is comprised of 50 trillion cells. And so the cells are the living entity. Bruce, by definition, is a community of 50 trillion cells. So think about it this way, as a human being is a skin-covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside. And the culture medium is called blood. In fact, when we define or decide how to make culture medium for cells, we try to match it to the blood. So culture medium is a synthetic, in a sense, blood. And so in a plastic dish, we create the culture medium from trying to complement the blood. So in your skin-covered petri dish, you have 50 trillion cells with culture medium, which is blood. And why is this relevant? And the answer is this. To the cell, It makes no difference if it's in a culture dish made out of plastic or inside a skin-covered culture dish. The fate of the cell is still controlled by the environmental information, which is called culture medium. And the culture medium of the blood is what controls the cells inside our skin-covered dish. And then we come to the next most important question. Since the composition of the culture medium is connected to the expression of the cells, then you come to a very important question. What controls the chemical composition of the blood? And the answer comes down, it's the brain. The brain is releasing neurochemicals, neurohormones, regulatory agents that are coordinating and, you know, conducting the concentrations of different things in the blood. So then I go, well, that's really cool. So the brain is the chemist that creates the culture medium, which by definition, the information in which that culture, that coming in that culture medium, controls the fate of the cells. That's a scientific connection. It's totally real. But then comes the next most important question is, okay, the brain controls the chemistry, which in turn controls via epigenetics the expression of the cells. And then the question is, yeah, but what chemistry should the brain release? And all of a sudden we jump to another level and it goes like this. It's related to the mind for the simple reason. The function of the brain is to connect the cells of our body with the environment outside so that the cells can adjust their biology just like cells in a petri dish adjusting to the environment. But the issue is this, my liver cell cannot see the outside directly, so that's why the nervous system connects my awareness of the outside through all my receptors to the brain, which then transmits the information to the cells, which controls their behavior so that the cells are still in harmony with what's going on in the environment. So all of a sudden I have the nervous system between the environment and the cells, and then I add this one aspect, but there's not just perception, there's interpretation. And interpretation is really what the mind is doing. So two people can be in exactly the same environment, but through their different interpretations, read it totally differently, seeing two different worlds in the exact same place. So the cells, what do the information to the cells get about the environment? What are you perceiving? Because your perception is converted into the chemistry released by the brain, which then goes to the cells and via epigenetics controls the genes. And all of a sudden it's like the mind-body connection is a physical mechanical connection, and the mind's energy, which is involved with neurological function, is what ultimately determines which secretions come out of that brain. Simple point, just simple, and I'll close on this part. Is simple point is this: I open my eyes and I see someone I love. The perception of that person and the interpretation of love from that person leads me to release chemicals from the brain that match the perception. Love is associated with dopamine release. It's associated with vasopressin release. It's associated with oxytocin release. It's associated with growth hormone release. Very interesting. If I take the chemicals just released by the brain in the perception of love and add it to a plastic culture dish with cells, the cells grow exuberantly well. And then all of a sudden you realize why people who fall in love almost always are, you know, exuberant in their own health. They glow with love because the chemistry going into the culture medium of love is a chemistry of health and growth. But I can just say the same person opens their eyes and sees something that scares them. Well, they're not going to release the chemistry of love. They start to release cortisol, inflammatory agents, stress agents into the blood. And these agents, if I add them to a plastic petri dish, guess what? Cause the cells to shut down their growth and the cells begin to die. That's why fear causes death, because it shuts down the cells. And the significance about that is the same individual, two different perceptions, two different chemical compositions being controlled by the brain of love chemicals versus fear chemicals, and two different biologies totally result from this. And all of a sudden, we now have a whole scientific lineage from how a thought turns into a chemical released by the brain, which goes into the blood as a culture medium, which then goes to the surface of the cell where the receptors pick up the signals, and then the receptors send the information to the genes and adjust the genetics, and all of a sudden we're not victims of the genes. Our life is controlled by our perceptions. and that's where all of the new medicine has to go, because a recent article revealed that I said in my book originally about 5% of illness is related to genes, is now down to about 1%. and that we're beginning to see lifestyle and responses to life are responsible for the vast majority of illness on this planet.
So, Bruce, in a sense, you're talking about beliefs and how powerful beliefs are. But you went so fast there. There was nothing wrong with the way you did that. But it was just so cool that I'd like to bring us back and sort of recycle over that again.
Absolutely.
How do beliefs affect us, and in what sense are beliefs connected to genetic expression?
Okay. The concept of cells being controlled by environmental signals leads us to the first important point is, what are the environmental signals that cells respond to? And then I say, well, cells live in a culture medium. In a plastic dish, we call it culture medium. In the body, we call it blood. And that the chemistry of that blood is where the signals come from. Those are environmental signals. So whether there's estrogen or testosterone or serotonin or dopamine, whatever is out there, the cells are reading the chemistry, reading their environment just as much as we see or hear or smell. Cells read their environment of signals. The cells, to stay alive, have to respond to these environmental signals. So by reading the signals adjust the behavior of the cell so that the cell becomes a complement to the environment. It lives in harmony with the environment. So if there's a, you know, you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you know you have to run. And if there's a peaceful environment, you can relax. You're reading the environment and adjusting your biology. Just, even a simple understanding is this. You go outside and it's hot out. The temperature on the outside is being picked up by the nervous system, and then that information is then used to adjust your biology, your metabolism. You start to perspire and cool off. If you go outside and it's cold out, that signal information is picked up by the nervous system, interpreted, and then to keep you alive and your body temperature right thing, then your metabolism is raised to heat up. So basically, whether your metabolism and your heat, your body temperature goes up and down, is not controlled by the body per se, it's controlled by the environmental signal. And so, of course, there's all kinds of signals, and there are signals that promote growth, and there are signals that promote the need for protection. And so the biology has to read these signals. So we're back in the body. The cells are reading the environmental signals from the blood, but the environmental signals are really the result of signals sent by the brain to inform the community of cells what's going on in their world so that the cells, the 50 trillion cells that make up the body, can coordinate their behavior and their action to keep you alive. So to coordinate behavior and action, that's the function, the behavior, the genetics, the expression of the cells. And they're coordinated by the signals that come from the blood, but the signals from the blood are based on the brain's response to the environment. And so basically, then I say, what's the source of the control of my biology? And the answer is the signals from the environment, because they'll determine which behaviors are going to be expressed and which genes are going to be read. And if I change my response to the environment, then I change the signals going from my nervous system to my cells. And again, in that, I change the genetics and the behavior of the cell. So we've really come down to a basic understanding is the brain's chemical control of blood, which in turn are the signals that control the genes, which is the direct connection between brain action and our biological expression of our body and our health and our behavior. So all of a sudden it says, wow, this becomes important because where did you get your perceptions from?
I have often understood epigenetics as to be leading us to the conclusion that experience is what influences our genes.
Absolutely.
Can you take it from there? Why do we think that experience influences our genes?
Well, first of all, we have the knowledge of how we respond to life is based on our experiences. It's a habituation. This is how you learn how to do anything in life is you experience and then you create a response to it. And if you repeat the experience and the response, it becomes habit at some point. So our experiences shape these behaviors. And it's interesting because once you start to learn that the experiences are being programmed, and there's a reason why for this, it's very simple. In order to function in society, an individual, how many rules do you have to learn how to function in society? Who's in charge? How to say what? A parent talks differently to a child than it does to another adult. The parent talks differently to a policeman than to another person. Every one of these is a different form of behavior. And then it becomes really important. So if I want to be a member of my society, then I have to really have a knowledge of this behavior, how to do this. Otherwise, I won't fit. And so then I say, well, when does a child learn this? And so here's the interesting part. We now know that in the last trimester of pregnancy, in the first 7 years of our lives, our brains are operating at a lower EEG frequency than conventional consciousness, primarily theta. And there's a reason why, because theta, which is expressed as a state of imagination, and then you realize that kids, especially from 2 to 7, are functioning in theta. They share the real world with their imaginary world. They blend them together. This is the experience of a child. But there's a reason why, so that this is not just a coincidence or just, oh, it goes like this. In order to be conscious, you have to have data. And I'll give a simple example. Let's say I buy an iPod, and I take it out of the box, a fresh iPod out of the box, and I push the play button. And think of play as consciousness, because it's to create the playlist you create with that one. So I say, you get a brand new iPod, you take it out of the box, and you push the play button, and nothing happens. And somebody says, no, you can't have anything happen unless you put some programs in the hard drive. And then you can select from the programs and create a playlist. I go, oh, okay, guess what? Consciousness needs data. And so it's interesting, the first 7 years of a child, the brain is functioning at theta as a primary brain activity, and theta is hypnosis. And what that means is this: an individual child experiences life, and from those experiences, takes repetition from those and sees a repeat pattern. And when it gets a repeat pattern, it creates a habit. By once that pattern is ever seen again, it doesn't have to relearn it. It knows it every time. And this is necessary in order for us to be conscious. And so what's interesting is then, what does a child learn in the first 7 years? Learn how to be a member of a culture by observing their parents, siblings, community, all that kind of stuff. And more importantly, for our health, a child also learns who they are in that community. And you say, well, how does a child know who they are? And the answer is by simply this: because other people tell that person, that child, who they are, and the child is in hypnosis recording it. You're a wonderful, loving child. You're the most beautiful child ever. You can do anything in the world, which is unfortunately not the conventional programming that most get. Who do you think you are? You don't deserve that. You're not that good at this or that. These critical assessments, recognizing a child's just recording them, become our recorded life experiences and become our habits of life. And so when we get negative programming like that, that becomes a habit in our lives.
And how does that experience, or any experience really, affect our genes?
Well, because let's say if I... give a scenario. I'm in my backyard with my mother as an infant. A snake slithers across the backyard. My mother sees the snake, screams her bloody head off, life or death situation. I, as a child, watch my mother see the snake and snake is extremely dangerous. I could die. And then I just say, well, and then the snake continues, goes into the next yard. There's another infant exactly my age, and their mother is a biologist. And the snake comes in, and it's a nice garden snake. And she picks up the snake and shows it to the child and shows how wonderful the snake is and everything. And the child's experience is that. Now, both of us are older. We're walking down the street together. A snake comes in front of us. And guess what? My life experience is, oh, my God, this is going to kill me. This is going to threaten. Hormones run through my body. Stress. I'm freaked out. The person sitting next to me sees the exact same thing. It's totally calm. Like, oh, cool, what a neat garden snake that is. And why is that relevant? Because these responses to life experiences translate into the biochemistry of our body and our behavior. And we learn them. And then they're automatic after that. So when that snake shows up, my immediate response is my first response. Oh, my God, this is deadly. And my whole physiology is completely altered by that. If I live in a world of snakes and I have that belief, you can bet my life will be fully stressed from 1 minute to the next minute. And yet the questions are, well, what are the snakes in our world? What are the things we're afraid of and all these things? Why? Because if we buy certain things that are causing us that fear in our early life experiences, then as we go through life from day to day, those are the signals from the environment that push the buttons and control our behavior and our genetics through epigenetics.
Let's talk about fractal geometry and fractal patterns and the structure of cells. How does that play in here?
How do we know anything in science? And the answer is, well, we do all this research. And I say, yeah, but how do we know when something is true or not? And the answer is it becomes predictable, that something that you understand, you could predict the outcome. And so that it really becomes incumbent upon us to recognize that how did we learn was through pattern. I did the experiment, and every time I did the experiment, I get the same answer. I say, oh, I got the pattern. That's how it works. Then I got a scientific fact. Well, an interesting fact of science is that nature has a geometry. It's geometry, just first of all, is structure in space, the math of making structure in space. When we grew up, the conventional geometry we learned is the geometry of triangles, squares, cubes, spheres, and stuff like that, Euclidean geometry. And then I say, well, that's nice geometry. We build our buildings, make our machines, and all that using that geometry. But I say, can you make a tree with that geometry? Can you make a cloud with that geometry? You know, can you make an animal? And the answer is no. And all of a sudden we realize, guess what? There's a different geometry that makes living structures in the planet. It's been more recently understood in the 80s as a new geometry called fractal geometry. And what it really represents is this. It's a complete different geometry, because fractal geometry is not very complicated. It's in fact a very simple geometry. It's you use the same equation and just repeat it by solving the equation, taking the answer that you get from the solving the equation, feeding it back into the equation, solve it again, get another answer, feed it back in, solve it again. And you can do this millions and millions of times. That's why to see what the outcome would be required the development of the computer. So fractal geometry didn't come real until about 1980s when computers were able to say, let's make 2 million repetitions of this and plot the data. And when they did, they found that that geometry mimicked nature, that the structures of nature were reflected in fractal geometry. In fact, you can put in a computer program of a fractal, put in some data in a fractal and get a plant or a snail or something comes out of the geometry by sticking a number in it. And all of a sudden you say, wow, that's the geometry of nature. And everybody goes, okay, big deal. So we have a new geometry for nature than the one we learned. I go, no. A fundamental characteristic of fractal geometry is that you use the same equation repeated over and over again. The significance is that in a fractal expression, the images repeat themselves at self-similar, almost identical expressions at any level of the organization. It's the epitome, or it's the mathematical expression of an ancient mystical statement, as above, so below. All of a sudden, it's not just, oh, that's a nice little old mystical statement. I say, no, that is a characteristic feature of fractals, which then, if you understand nature is fractal, then it says, oh my God, there are repeat patterns that you can see by looking at nature. And one of those repeat patterns in this case is, why do we study cell biology? And the answer is because a cell is a miniature human by function. A conventional cell has every system that is in your body is already in a single cell. Respiration, digestion, excretion, reproduction, nervous system, endocrine system. Cells have immune systems. Relevant, a cell is a fractal image of a human. Why is that important? Because if you understand the patterns of a cell, then inherently, because of a fractal and self-similarity, the human will have self-similar patterns. And that's why you can use cell biology research and apply it directly to a human. Cells and humans are fractal images of each other. So this becomes important. It says, how can I translate cells into human medicine and human biology? And the answer is, because their functions are the same and they operate in the exact same way that we as humans do. And it's a built-in character of fractals, self-similarity, or as above, so below point, if we understand this, then we are opening our doors to get greater knowledge of the world, because if you can find something on a similar level, you know, a similar expression on a different level, and you know one level, you can apply that information to understanding the other level. Understanding how a cell works gives us insight to how a human works, which also gives us insight to the nature of our own imminent evolution, which is humans are the new version of a cell, and we are coming together with 7 billion cells creating a super organism called humanity. And that's the patterns of all that are similar between the cell, the human, and civilization.
So, Bruce, I'd like to switch now from fractal geometry to brain programming in utero. And I know that's a little bit of a jump there, but what does the recent research that you're aware of say about the influence of the mother and on brain, fetal brain development?
Oh, this is very, very important and very interesting information, and it's critical, actually. And it goes like this. When I was teaching in medical school, what did we teach? We taught that genes control the development of an organism, and the role of a mother is to take this fertilized egg with its genes and support it by providing it with nutrition, and that genes would control the development of the child, and the mother controls the availability of nutrition. And so back in those days, we, you know, say, well, to a woman who was asking, well, what can I do to be a better mother in this case? She said, well, eat well, take vitamins and supplements, do exercises, these kind of things. Why? It enriches your nutritional source. Well, that was in the old days when we thought genes control things. But now with the science of epigenetics, we recognize, no, the environment is what's controlling the unfolding of that. So all of a sudden I say, oh, well, the mother's providing blood. That's the nutrition. And I go, yeah, but there's a heck of a lot more stuff in blood than just the nutrition. All the emotional chemistry, all the regulating hormones, all the growth factors that are controlling her biology to the world. Remember, her biology is being controlled by her experience of the world. And so if she's afraid, then she's going to release stress hormones into her blood. Well, what's the relevance? Not only is nutrition crossing the placenta, all of the information is crossing the placenta. So if the mother is in stress because of whatever she's life experiencing at that time, the chemistry of her blood is going to express the stress, which is going to control her biology to respond to her world. But that signaling also crosses into the placenta. So the fetus, which is growing in that environment, has an environment of culture medium that has stress hormones in it. And the significance is that the fetus's physiology is the same as the mother. If the mother feels fear, the fetus feels fear physiologically. The difference is the mother has an interpretation of why she feels the fear. The child just feels the fear. It doesn't have any awareness of what's going on, except the environment is stressful and scary, and this becomes, you know, influential. And I say, well, how is it influential? Epigenetics. The signals from the environment program the biology. So now here's the most fundamental difference, and this is very critical, because when we talk about the stress influences on the body, I say, well, when I'm releasing stress hormones, what physiologically is going to happen to me? And the number one thing is this. The blood vessels in the gut are going to constrict. And they're going to constrict because it forces the blood from the viscera, which is growth and maintenance of the body, and pushes it to the outside, to the arms and legs, where I'm going to have to fight or flight for my survival. So I deplete my visceral organs of blood as I preferentially push it into my arms and legs. So I said, well, what would be the consequence of that? And here's a simple understanding. The amount of nutritional energy provided by the blood that a developing tissue gets controls its development. You give it a lot of energy and nutrition, it grows really big. You give it a small supply of energy and nutrition, it doesn't grow much at all. So then I say, okay, what is the expression of the epigenetics, which controls the behavior and the genetics of the cell, when there's stress in the mother's blood? What happens in the fetus? The answer is the stress hormones cross into the placenta. Now they're the blood of the fetus. The signals are now bathing the fetal cells. The environmental signals are adjusting the behavior and the physiology of the fetus. And I say, what is it going to do? Exactly the same as it did in the mother. It's going to cause the blood vessels in the gut to constrict. and open up the blood vessels in the arms and legs. And I say, well, what's the consequence of that? Well, if blood determines the development, then this child is going to have a greatly developed arms and legs when it's born. But it's going to be at the expense of a depleted visceral system, but it's going to have really strong arms and legs. And then I go, well, okay, what else does the stress hormones do? I said, well, number one, two, they shut off the immune system to conserve energy, and that's going to affect the immune system of this child because you're depressing immune function during development. And then I say, thirdly, and this is the one that most important when talking about brain function, is this. When you're in fight or flight, you use hindbrain function to operate from, not creative conscious thinking. Conscious thinking is too slow in an emergency. You know, if your car is going out of control and you had to just live in your conscious mind for that moment, all you'd be doing is holding on the wheel going, oh my God, even before you could think of a response. But what happens is you don't stay in the conscious mind when stress is there. And why? And the answer is because the stress hormones, remember I said in the gut, the stress hormones cause the blood vessels to constrict, which pushes the blood to the periphery. We now know that in the forebrain, when the stress hormones are in the system, the blood vessels of the forebrain constrict. Why? To push extra blood to the hindbrain, because I'm going to be operating from hindbrain reflex behavior. I'm not going to be operating from thinking. So I say, then what would be the consequence of a child raised in a stressful environment where the fetus, where the mother is in a stressful environment? And the answer is the blood flow to the gut will deplete the development of the viscera, but make very large arms and legs. The blood flow in the brain will shorten the development of the conscious part, the prefrontal cortex, but will enhance the development of the hindbrain so that there's great control of those large muscles in the arms and legs. And I say, well, what is the consequence? And the answer is this. When a woman finds herself with a fetus and she lives in a very stressful environment, she creates a street fighter. And that's the design of nature. And the answer is, why would nature do that? And the answer is, well, if the world is as bad as the mother perceives it, then the most effective child that will be produced is one that will fight its way to survival. And so we shift a child into a street fighter with large hindbrain to coordinate the large physical body. In contrast, if the mother lives in a happy, wonderful, supporting environment, blood preferentially goes to the viscera and to the forebrain. And therefore, the amount of consciousness of a child that is grown in a happy environment is enhanced way beyond that of a child in a stressful environment, because you're feeding the forebrain, allowing the development and the nutrition to nourish this part of our brain, enhance its function. And the viscera are going to be extra strong, so the child will be healthy for a long lifetime compared to a child who grew up in a stressful environment. So parenting, the conscious part of the gestation part, is very critical, because the mother's perception is exchanged into chemistry by her brain to control her body, but that chemistry also controls the fetus in the same response. And it's interesting, because if there's repetition of pattern, the fetus learns the pattern. And you say, well, why is that relevant? I go, well, think about behavior. Consider behavior a song. It has lyrics and music. Now consider the emotions, the music, and the life experiences providing the lyrics. Well, if there's a repeat pattern of emotions that the mother is experiencing, then the child is recording the music of that emotional, programming. And when it's born, it will create life experiences that will create the lyrics to go along with the music. So a child is being pre-programmed by patterns that the mother is experiencing in her world.
So let's go in from there, from the infant in the womb to all the way to adulthood, pre-adulthood, and so forth, and think about epigenetics and quantum physics and how that explains relationships or feelings of romantic love.
Yeah. During our development, of course, that's where we start to experience the world, and we have sensory experiences coming in. But the sensory experiences are also influenced by what's going on around us as well. So we're not just having a feeling of love, but we see love in relation to what does it reflect in our world. So we start to connect the physical world with our emotional connections, okay? In the first 7 years, This is the part where I said, look, you have to download the programs. The child is essentially in a state of hypnosis. And the significance is to get who we are and how we function in culture, the thousands of things that we have to know, that's the way you facilitate the download, is just have the brain record these life experiences. Well, these life experiences are like programs in a jukebox. If a certain set of stimuli show back up, it can push the button and engage a program associated with those stimuli. So if I saw the snake as an infant, and then see the snake as adult, same snake, or different snake, but snake, button push, boom, behavior, automatic unfolding. Well, this becomes very critical because it says that our fundamental behavior is stored in the subconscious as programs that are based on our life experiences. And then I say, but now I get to be conscious. And here's the beautiful part. The conscious and subconscious minds are profoundly different in regard to A, how they learn, and B, their functions. And if we don't understand the profound differences between the two, then it leads to a lot of confusion. And that confusion then leads to a lot of problems with dealing with our lives. And it goes like this. Let's define first the conscious mind. It's the latest development of the brain. It's the prefrontal cortex, a lobe of tissue right behind the forehead. The prefrontal cortex is a seat of our personal identity, our uniqueness, our spirit. That's where we as individuals reside, the prefrontal cortex. Prefrontal cortex, about 10% of the brain, 90% is the rest of the brain back there. So if the prefrontal cortex is the seat of consciousness, the other 90% is the seat of the subconscious. Now here's what the difference is. The conscious mind connected to our personal identity is unique because it's creative. It's the mind that can imagine and put things together and create what humans, the level of humanity's expression is through this creative mind. The subconscious mind, in contrast, is not very creative at all. It's like a precocious 5-year-old. It's primarily habitual. The subconscious mind is primarily habitual. It learns a set of stimuli. When they show up, it engages a behavior that complements those stimuli by learning from these experiences. So the conscious mind is creative, and in that regard, being also the seat of who we are, we use that creativity to have wishes and desires and aspirations for life. I say, Ruth, what do you want from your life? And an answer, it's going to be creative because it's what you want coming up. It's not here, so you're going to create. And I say, well, oh, I want to be healthy. I want to have great romance. I want to have a great job. I go, good, that's good creative thinking. It's positive thinking. It's the positive creative thinking. And I go, and what about the subconscious? I say, well, subconscious is not really a thinking mind. It's a stimulus response mind. Push the button, play the program. And then we go, okay, so I see that. And I say, well, where do I get the programs from? And I say, well, here's the problem. The fundamental programs in our mind, our subconscious mind, didn't come from our creativity. The fundamental programs came in the first 7 years, last trimester of pregnancy, first 7 years, downloading other people's experiences as ours. So the fundamental programs in our subconscious minds do not in any way reflect our wishes or desires or aspirations or other people's lives. And when we have to remember, when these were downloaded, consciousness was not yet a predominant brain function. So what was downloaded didn't go through consciousness. It was just downloaded straight into the system. So we didn't filter the download. We just got the download. And then I say, well, okay, so we have fundamental programs, and these fundamental programs aren't even ours. We observed our mother, father, family, other people. I go, okay. So I say, well, but the creative conscious mind is the one I really like. That's the one that I can manifest the life that I want. I go, yeah. And then I go, well, here's a problem. I said that the two minds don't learn in the same way, and there's one other big difference. Let me just bring this primary difference up. The conscious mind is not time-bound, meaning, what are you doing next week? Your conscious mind lets go of the moment, moves into like a Rolodex, moves into next week. What am I doing? Okay, seeing that. I go, okay, wait, what'd you do last week? Conscious mind lets go of the present moment. Rolodex goes backwards and says what I did last week. Or I say, in your mind, I want you to think of this. And your mind lets go of the current moment because now it's going up into a thinking place. Okay? Significance, very profound. Every time the mind is in thought, the conscious mind, by definition, it's not paying attention. Well, that doesn't mean you stop and the biology in your life just like a robot, all of a sudden the power shuts off and you're just standing there as you're thinking. There's a default, and the default is the subconscious mind. So when I let go of conscious control, I go to autopilot. And the autopilot knows how I speak. It knows what I do for a living. It knows how to drive the car. It knows how to do all the things. So basically, but it's doing it from programs. So now here comes the problem. We believe that we're running our lives with our conscious wishes, desires, and aspirations. Then we go out in the world and then find out we're always hitting the wall. It doesn't seem to work. We come home at night going, oh my God, it's like the universe must be against me because I wanted to be successful and I'm working so hard and it's not really working. So it's not me. It's the invisible thing out there. And so I'm a victim. Now comes the truth. And this becomes so liberating. And it goes like this. It is now recognized by neuroscience that we are probably spending anywhere between 1% to 5% of our life being controlled by conscious minds, wishes, desires, and aspirations. The reason why it's a very small percent is because it turns out that about 95% of the time or more, we're thinking. And when we're thinking, by definition, we default to the subconscious because the conscious mind's not paying attention. So why is this important? The conscious mind has your wishes, desires, positive thoughts working about 5% of the time. But 95% of the time, you're coming from the fundamental programs that you got in your subconscious mind and then recognizing that those basic programs are not even ours. And as psychologists suggest, 70% or more are disempowering, limiting, and self-sabotaging beliefs. And why is this relevant? Because then it says 95% of the time, we are engaging in behaviors that do not conform to our wishes and desires. And then comes the part that is the monkey wrench in the big picture. When we shift into the subconscious programming, we're shifting in because the conscious mind is busy. Well, when the conscious mind is busy, then by definition, it's not paying attention. And if it's not paying attention, then most of the time it never observes our own behavior. But it all turns out, but that behavior we're playing that we're not paying attention to isn't our own behavior, it's the behavior we're downloaded with. And if there are negative behaviors or self-sabotaging behaviors, we play them. And yet we are the ones that don't see them. So when I give a lecture, Ruth, I have an audience and I say, look, I'm sure you had a friend you were close to when you were very young and you knew your friend's behavior very, very well. And you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day you see that your friend shares some of the same behavior with their parent. So you volunteer, you know, something really casual. You go, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. And you back away from Bill, who goes totally ballistic. How can you compare me to my dad? And most people laugh because they're familiar with it. And I say, most profound story is this. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The one who doesn't see it is Bill. And the reason why is he playing his dad's behavior? Because his subconscious and he downloaded it. But why is he playing it? And the answer is because his conscious mind's busy and he's on automatic and he doesn't see it. And then all of a sudden you realize then you put the picture together and you say, oh my God, we're going out there trying to create our lives. We struggle through all this stuff. And we believe that the struggle is because the universe doesn't support us, wishes and desires. And now it turns out is this is not true at all. It's our own invisible behavior that we got from other people sabotages us. And there's this wonderful movie, I'm sure most people have seen it, called The Matrix. And The Matrix is, you go to the video stores in science fiction, and really The Matrix should be a documentary. It is a documentary. Basically said, we've been programmed. And I say, yep, we have. We've all been programmed. Up through seven, that's programming period. And the movie, and this is the fun part, they say, well, if you take the blue pill, you go back into the program and life will go on just the way it's always going. Or you can take the red pill and get out of the programming. Well, they never really say, well, what would life be if I took the red pill and got out of the programming? And this is what introduces me to my new book and introduce you as the honeymoon effect. And I say, well, what's the honeymoon effect? And I say, think about it this way. For most people, when they fall in love, I say, go back to a time you fell head over heels in love with somebody. It didn't have to last long. Could have been a week, a month, a year, if you're lucky. I say, this honeymoon effect, what was it? I say, well, first of all, almost everybody, when they fell in love, was exuberantly healthy. And And there's a reason why. When you fall in love, as we mentioned, you release the chemistries such as vasopressin and growth hormones and these other things, which really enhance our biologies. That's why we glow when we're in love. We're making culture medium for the best for ourselves. Then I say, we also had energy, and everybody laughs because they know they made love for days without stopping for food or sleep. You know, they had energy all over the place. And then I ask people, I say, go back to the time you fell in love, and was life so beautiful that you couldn't wait for the next day to have more? And almost everybody goes, yeah. And I said, well, it was like heaven on earth, wasn't it? And it was like, yeah, it was so beautiful. And now here's the interesting science behind that. Science has now recognized that when you fall in love, it's the one time in your life that you don't really default to the subconscious program. You stay mindful, you stay present. And the reason is very simple. Everything you were ever looking for is now in front of your face. Why would you let your mind wander when what you wanted is right here? So you keep your conscious mind present. I say, well, why is that important? Because it's a period where you're not playing programs from the subconscious. I say, well, what's the consequence of living from the conscious mind? Wishes and desires and aspirations. The answer is you manifest with another person who's also doing the same, wishes, desires, and aspirations. And when you did that, and both of the partners were not operating from subconscious programs, they manifested heaven on earth. So simple point is, what is the consequence of taking the red pill? And the answer is creating heaven on earth. It's the programming that has disabled us and made dysfunction in our world. Because when you stop playing the program and you start living from wishes and desires, boom, you created heaven on earth. So all of a sudden it's like, well, that's pretty direct feedback about the nature of the influence of the programming, because again, science revealed that 90% or more of the time when you're in love, you are operating totally from conscious mind, wishes and desires, positive thinking, and we manifested a life that way. So that's real critical to understand that, is that this is an example that shows, what is the influence of that program? And the answer is, well, what is the influence when you're not being programmed? And all of a sudden you see the difference between a honeymoon world and a world that sometimes looks like hell.
I'm afraid we're going to stop already. That was amazing. And we only scratched the surface and really got into the whole thing of love and so forth. People, if you want to refer more to this, Bruce's most recent book is The Honeymoon Effect. And we'll send you the links to all of those. So, Bruce, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's nice to see you again and to spend this time, this hour, talking with you and kind of going with you on this trail of thoughts. That's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so very much again for speaking with you and for speaking with your audience, because simple point is, if everybody understands this, then the truth is the earth does become heaven. If everybody is living this life and finding heaven, then it turns into it. And that's what I'm hoping our evolution will lead us to.
We hope you've enjoyed part one of this short, focused course. Next, in part two, we'll dig more deeply into the teaching you've just heard. This segment will help you synthesize key concepts so you can use them immediately. After that, you'll discover concrete strategies in part three for implementing this course in your life and with your patients. In part four, the Quick Start Guide, you'll get the core ideas and techniques at a glance, so you'll have a cheat sheet when you need it most. And part five gives you the complete transcript of the course so you can quickly recall crucial details and apply them with confidence. You'll find the links for each of these on the confirmation page you received when you purchased the course. Thanks for watching.